question. Is body scan as a meditation practice done in the Ajahn Chah tradition? Is there a sutta where the Buddha talks about it? Well, Ajahn Chah would recommend doing anything that worked. So he wasn't really fixed on any particular technique. There isn't really the, say, the Ajahn Chah meditation. So that if a body scan is helpful, then it would be encouraged. And there are actually many talks where Ajahn Chah recommends reflecting on the body. Both, I mean, there's the traditional recollection of the body as in its 32 parts, starting from the outside and going in, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, and then going into the body, sort of taking it apart. So that's a very ordinary practice that's encouraged by actually most of the forest teachers. And the Buddha gives several different body contemplations, particularly in the discourse on the four foundations of mindfulness in the section on the body. And there's the recollections of the body in terms of those 32 parts, recollection of the body in terms of elements, and going through the body and identifying elements in terms of solid element, liquid element, the air element, the heat element, and so then using that to go through the body in various ways. Also various contemplations of the body as a corpse, seeing the inevitable destination of the body. So the Buddha uses that kind of meditation practice, advises it. And the purpose, the goal of those practices is to encourage a dispelling of the infatuation and identification with the body. Is there something in the body? This is the next question. Is there something in the body that will help you identify the defilement of delusion? Yes, there is. The feeling, this is me. that's the fundamental delusion. So that's if you can keep seeing that and challenge that, then yeah, you'll crack the nut of delusion. Okay, if one has read the Majjhima Nikaya, which is the middle-length discourses of the Buddha, what text of the Pali Canon do you recommend reading next? Well, there's actually two new translations of, one more recent than the other. There's the Connected Discourses, the Samyutta Nikaya, and those were actually, it's quite a few years ago now, probably 7 or 8, that it was translated. And that's a really, in terms of a practice manual. I mean, it's a big manual, but it has many of the elements of practice and training in that. And then, about a year or so ago, then the numerical discourses on Guttara Nikaya was published, and those are a much broader range of discourses that what they're organized according to the, as I said, numerical discourses, the ones of this, the twos of that, the threes of that, and so that's the theme that follows through, and that covers a very wide range of topics, and both in terms of practice and ethics and things that are useful for living in the world, things that are useful for those who are meditators. It has a very broad range of subject material, so that there, those are both excellent sutta compilations to that are worthy of reading. I'm having trouble integrating some of the teachings in the context of preparing to have a child. Reflections on aging, illness, and death, and the fact that birth is dukkha have taken on a heavy and somber tone for me in this time. How might one be fully open to the lightness and joy surrounding birth while remaining deeply aware of these other truths of existence? Thank you for your thoughts. Yeah, I think one of the things is to really recognize that, especially on a retreat, and given the demographics of most of the people on the retreat, their aging, illness, and death is more of a theme. so that in terms of preparation for having a child, I think it's really those contemplations are helpful in the sense of having a not in terms of creating a somber, heavy tone, but in terms of recognizing the responsibility that one's taking on, and then really making that a very conscious quality, so that there's an ability to approach that the opportunity of bringing a life into the world, so that there one is creating the conditions for oneself and this little being to be surrounded by care and compassion and love, and to be nurtured in ways that are not feeding attachment and fear. That there's a real kind of an atmosphere of trust and care that. Yeah, so that by recognizing the full spectrum of what life is, then there's a real care and attentiveness to wanting to provide the opportunity for a young child to be able to grow up with that surrounded by caring. It's a real, it's an incredible gift. Um, They're also you can look for the T-shirt. Yeah, I got. You can look for the T-shirt. We have kind of the youngest. Probably the youngest member of the Ubayagiri community came for a baby blessing, and he had his little T-shirt on with our little little boxes and with the birth, aging, sickness, death, and sort of the birth was checked off. That's a great T-shirt. I've got it in the every year. I make a kind of a yearbook, a photo album to take to Thailand, and yeah, we've got a picture of Leo and his little T-shirt and during the baby blessing. It's very sweet. Yeah, and I think that's also part of the kind of recognizing, I think, you know, similar to how Ajahn Kurundamo speaking this afternoon of the range of, there's a fuller range of say, yeah, what we do in Buddhist practice outside of, it isn't limited to, you know, a meditation or a meditation retreat, and that the kind of blessing ceremonies and monasteries are places where children and families are it's really a part of the atmosphere, and I think it lends itself to recognizing that, you know, there's a whole other sphere of themes that are part of the spectrum of life that we bring in. Okay, this one. Sorry, I missed something. Did you say instead of dwelling on our hindrances and getting depressed, we could instead, working with the factors of enlightenment, to brighten our mind? What are the factors you would suggest? So it's a better option, the factors of awakening that the Buddha himself pointed to are those factors of mindfulness, of investigation of dhammas, of effort, of joy, rapture, tranquility, samadhi, concentration, and equanimity. So those are uplifting qualities and bright qualities of mind to be directing attention to. And of course, other aspects of that one can be directing attention to, say the four Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, compassion, gladness, and equanimity. Those are brightening qualities. The qualities that are spiritual perfections. Aspects of the parami, generosity, virtue, patience, effort, adhitana, satya, truthfulness, and a variety, a few others. Those are all qualities that we can be directing our attention to, so that the goal, of course, is how to increase wholesome mental states and relinquish unwholesome mental states. How to support the qualities of mind that are for the relinquishing of suffering and kind of un. I mean, there is a the Ajahn Jeff translates Nibbana as unbinding, and even though I feel it's a clunky term, it has a really apt connotation in that sense of, yeah, that unbinding, the picking apart and loosening the grip of things that create suffering. Remember Ajahn Chah one time saying that, you know, practicing Dhamma is like taking a screwdriver and unscrewing something rather than putting the screwdriver in and tightening it up. And so that's sort of simple. So that our recognize and what are the things that help us to, okay, how do we loosen that nut? How do we loosen that screw rather than kind of keep bearing down on it and tightening it? You know, if only I work harder, I'll be better somehow. But so you just keep tightening it up. So it's important to recognize. That's what the, you know, these different, and even if we're contemplating the hindrances, the reason for contemplating the hindrances is to see how do we unbind, how do we loosen, how do we untighten the grip that it has over us. Can you please give perspective on how to work with thoughts/feelings of inadequacy in comparison to others? I think one of the things is recognizing from a Buddhist perspective that, yeah, any comparison to others is always going to end up in suffering. It's like when the Buddha, what is sometimes, sometimes it's almost always translated as conceit from the Pali word. It's the comparison to others in terms of either inferior, equal, or superior. So that, and whether one is equal or inferior or superior, it doesn't really matter. It's the act of comparing that's always going to end up in suffering. So that recognizing that, and that's why the function of the perspectives of Dhamma is giving us the opportunity to step out of that me and other position. We can look at things in terms of cause and effect relationships, as opposed to there being having to be a me embedded in that. And because as soon as we buy into that, and the same with that, that skillful and unskillful, that when I was saying that when we see things according to Dhamma or use the Dhamma as a perspective, we start looking at things in terms of skillful and unskillful, wholesome and unwholesome. Is this have a wholesome, skillful, pleasant result? Or does it have a unpleasant, unwholesome, unskillful result? And it's not really about the me in it. It's more the stepping back and seeing it from a perspective of what's for our benefit and growth, what's for our well-being and happiness. As long as we have a fear that coming from an I position, there's always going to be a sense of inadequacy in some way. I remember one time, it's not quite the same, but I think these are tied in because in the sense of so like the feeling of kind of a feeling of guilt or that how one and self judgment. I remember being in, actually it was in New Zealand, and I was acting as a translator and attendant for a senior Thai monk, and who's a very well-known teacher, a very lovely monk. He's passed away now, but we had the evening puja, meditation, Dhamma talk, and then questions after, and then somebody posed the question of how to deal with the feelings of guilt and self-judgment, and I went to translate the question, and then burst out laughing because I didn't really know the word for it in Thai. Then I had to explain to the teacher, you know, what is it that a Westerner does to make them feel feelings of guilt and self-judgment? And it was, and he listened to it, and he was sort of, he had this very look of real concern. That's really suffering. To tell them not to do that. It was like just such a foreign concept for him. So I think it's helpful to know that it's a learned way of perceiving things, as opposed to a basic reality or fundamental truth. It's something that we've actually learned in a cultural way, so that we can unlearn it. We can see the drawbacks in it and cultivate skillful ways of holding our experience. Can you please talk about qualities one would experience in different jhana states, not just joy, rapture, happiness, but physical sensations and other identifiable qualities? I'm not sure if I have experienced past the first jhana and would like to know. Thank you for your kindness. I think one of the qualities that is helpful to pay attention to is just the stability, ease, and kind of a shedding. And it's as the mind becomes more peaceful and settled, then it just sheds more and is more steady and clear within itself. And now, I trained with Ajahn Chah, and he didn't really put a lot of emphasis on being able to identify, you know, every state and what its name was and what its number was, but to be able to pay attention to how to be present with a peaceful mind and how to allow that to be a force for settling and clarifying the heart. And so that's the more still internally we are. There's also a clarity, but also as we're talking, like a malleability. The mind doesn't become rigid; it becomes soft and clear. And not soft in terms of wishy-washy soft, but soft in the sense that it can easily adapt itself. It isn't easily shaken. So those are qualities to pay attention to and to nurture. Are there harmful states of concentration? How would potentially you go down the wrong path? Is there a question you could ask yourself? I mean, there are harmful states of concentration in the sense that as one is able to concentrate the mind more, one can start to push away things. There's a strength of mind that starts to be built, and one starts to push away things one doesn't like, and then one can become more rigid in one's both in one's view and one's ability. And I mentioned in the last question that ability to of softness and adaptability, sort of where I was able to be soft and adapt. An idiom in Thai, which sort of points to the, and I'm trying to remember it all. Sort of like the pointing to the flaws or foibles, sort of like kamatan ki grod. So that's like a meditator who's irritable, and then something like sando ki kho. Sort of somebody who is supposed to be content, but then is always asking for things. So then that you recognize, oh, as the mind becomes more concentrated, sometimes we can justify, because the goal becomes more important than the actual, what we're experiencing and what we're doing. So then we and can easily become more rigid, more unable to adapt and have an ease with adaptation, because we want to protect our precious little peaceful mind, and that isn't very useful. So that's a harmful aspect. Sometimes also in terms of harmful states of concentration, in terms of becoming rigid in terms of one's views, becoming more, because one doesn't want to have to deal with the complexity. I mean, it's almost like, there's a certain fundamentalist attitude where one wants to keep it very simple And then one's views start to get more rigid. And especially as the mind becomes more settled, one's able to hold those views more strongly, which is sometimes not a good thing. So those are drawbacks that can happen. About a year ago, I was bullied and sexually harassed by a married male co-worker. The issue was addressed by the managers, mainly due to fear of a lawsuit. I see this man at the office from time to time, and when he says a polite hello, I feel a tightness in my throat, chest, and abdomen. The thought of sending metta to this man still makes my body and mind tighten. Any guidance is how I can work with this and move beyond it. I think the person one should be sending metta to is oneself, really looking after oneself, and just to be able to not get, because sometimes we say to not be swept up in anger that's a big accomplishment already. So that sense of assuming that one should be having thoughts of loving kindness to somebody is a huge, if they've been inappropriate in their conduct toward one, I think it's a really nice ideal, but I don't think we need to be trying to force ourselves to comply with ideals. You have to learn how do I not suffer, and that's a different question and a different approach. So that being able to clarify for oneself, how do I look after myself with metta? How do I look after myself with kindness? And then how do I live in work in a situation like that where I can maximize the actual trust with other co-workers and develop a sense of safety in the workplace. So it's there's the recognition that people they do things out of ignorance and delusion, but you still, it's good sometimes to remember when the Buddha gave the discourse, and we chanted it last night, was it? Discourse on the Highest Blessings. The very first thing that is the basis of a blessing, mangala, something leading to well-being, is to not associate with fools. And just if somebody and it's not that one has to be judging or having to carry that around, but it's, there's people you should be associating with, and there's people that it's more worthwhile to avoid and not have contact with. Would you please elaborate on mental formations and volition? I thought mental formations are thoughts and images that pop up and are not necessarily originated by our will or wish. Otherwise, we could easily also will or wish them away. That our effort is in recognizing them when they arise, not cling to them and let them pass like clouds. Am I mistaken? I think it's just it's a bigger picture around that. that category of mental formations are the there is the volition behind it, but it can be quite so there's a whole range of that volition intention behind it, so that some of the thoughts can be very weak because the volition is weak. Some of the thoughts can be quite well formed and coherent because the volition behind them is so that. But that category of mental formations really does cover all the different types of thoughts, emotions, images. It's because some of the things that, say, images that come up in the mind that sort of pop in and pop out, oftentimes that's perception, like association. That's the function of perception. And that's not really, that's not dependent on volition. And there's, because that's where, that's how perception works. It's making those associations and trying to find labels and categories to fit experience in. So it's not really, it's not really, say, there isn't a volition behind that. It's just how the mind is working, trying to make our experience more coherent. So that and a lot of that, you just let that wash through, because it's it doesn't have there's not an impulsion in the mind, so that the mental formations are a bit more, maybe a bit more fully formed, they need to be. That's where the training and application of effort is in recognizing them more clearly. Once I aspired to open my mind beyond this conditioned world. Now I mostly try to be at ease with my limitations. Am I mistargeting something important? I don't think so. You know, in the sense that I think that's there's a certain hubris of youth that and when we're younger and there's fired up with idealism and what we're going to do and what we're going to accomplish, and as we keep doing it, you realize, well, it's not as easy as we thought. It's not and sometimes it isn't even at all like we thought it. So that paying attention to what are the limitations? How do I? And I think that's why the Buddha is so skillful in using. Say like the Four Noble Truths as a way to look at our experience. He's not looking at it in an ideal way of focus on being liberated and enlightened, because what does that mean? Focus on what are the limitations? Where's the suffering? Where's the difficulty? Where's the the where's the rub, so that you're willing to work with that, and you say, well, and it's more like the Buddha being approaching it like a doctor, and looking at, well, where's the pain? Where is the particular illness displaying itself? And then you can start working with it, as opposed to setting up an ideal of what one thinks one should be gaining or getting or becoming. Some monks have told me I'm selfish for being so focused on release. They say I should help others more. What are your thoughts? Just as a generalization, the tendency to focus on release or on enlightenment is so often driven by an ideal, and ideals are oftentimes pretty distant from reality, so that and that there seem to be free from all suffering, free from all defilement, except when I have to deal with human beings and people. How's that work? So that's learning how to deal skillfully with other human beings, learning how to inhabit the world as it is. What are the four stages of enlightenment? What defilements have the four noble beings shed? I mean, there's kind of the classical lists of the different types of defilements and nuances, but it all boils down to greed, hate, and delusion, and it's pretty basic and simple how the different forms of greed, desire, attachment, or aversion, ill will, irritation, delusion in terms of the aspects of doubt, and of course it feeds into clinging, attachment, self-perceptions, and uncertainty, wavering. So those are shed as one continues to see the drawback in them, see the pain that's associated with them. So that's when we think of say enlightenment, and it's that a being who is willing and able to relinquish those things that are complicating and constricting. Could you please expand on compassionate seclusion in interactive daily life, both on and off retreat? I think one of the things is knowing one's boundaries and knowing one's habits and knowing one's tendencies, because and each of us are somewhat different, and but it's like seclusion, and certainly in terms of compassionate seclusion. We need to give ourselves time to settle, to regenerate our internal resources, and that can be shorter or longer periods. It can be done in different ways, whether it's just going for a walk by oneself, or working in a garden, or whatever, as opposed to sitting in meditation, having a place of physical seclusion. There's many different ways that one can be accomplishing that, and it is an act of compassion toward oneself to be looking after oneself in that way, recognizing that how do we balance our time of kind of regenerating and rejuvenating the heart, and then engaging with others and with the world around us, and it's compassionate to others when we do that, because if we're able to be we're much more able to be present for others in a skillful way when we're not feeling frazzled or overwhelmed by the contact of our interactions, so that it's helpful to recognize what are my boundaries, what are my capabilities, and to and sometimes we have to stretch our boundaries. Sometimes we have to push the envelope a bit. But there is a very human need for all of us to have time where we can be on our own and not have to be interacting all. Thank you, Lumpal, for your time and teachings. I would like to hear more about the idea of restraint. With our children, we talk about exercising restraint, like exercising a muscle, and how important exercising restraint is. Can you please share your thoughts regarding restraint? As our eldest rapidly approaches teenager land, it seems more important than ever. That sense of recognizing that there, it's something that can be cultivated, it can be developed, as in the example of one can exercise physically, and something that comes to mind is with Ajahn Chah saying, like, when you exercise physically, that's how you make yourself strong. But when you pay attention to inner stillness, that's how you make your mind strong. So that restraint also comes from not just holding back, but also being able to turn inward and recognize that. Being able to tune in to how things feel, how they affect one, and I think especially in terms of say like teenagers, I think in a culture like this, there's just so many external pulls that to being of course, it depends on them, but that encouragement to really tuning in and paying attention to how does it feel? What does that contact feel like? What is the result? And then restraint becomes more natural when you recognize, oh, when I don't engage in this way, when I don't get caught up in that, then it feels better. It actually makes me more happy. There's also just the aspect in terms of that restraint is a a natural constituent of living a skillful life, in the same way that like we're driving a car, it's helpful to have an accelerator, it's helpful to have brakes, so that the restraint is more the brakes, and a car without even if you got a brand new high end car but no brakes, it's a problem. Would you please talk a bit about karma in past lives and what specifications might lead to specific conditions in future lives? I always had a contemplative practice since childhood, communing with nature and looking for truth, but I came to the Buddhist teachings when I was 43 years old. Why would it take so long? I'm asking for future karmic results and preventing negative ones. One of the things that the Buddha said is that trying to figure out every single nuance and aspect of karma will make your head explode. So you can't really get too bogged down by the details, but the the patterns are very clear, in the sense that when one, just by paying attention to that appreciation, of what is leads to peace or leads to truth, then that pattern repeats itself. Developing of affinities to the Buddhist teachings, Buddhist practice, that repeats itself. That we draw that, if we're doing it something in this life, it'll tend to repeat itself. So that's a natural cause and effect condition. How do you teach noting/labeling in meditation? That is, do you note pain, tightness, tension, touch, all as sensations, or differently? Or all sounds as sounds? Or do you name their source, such as airplane, refrigerator, etc.? How about thought? Do you note them as thinking or thoughts, feelings, or do you name each? Actually, these days I don't note very much of all. If I teach that kind of technique of noting or labeling, it's usually as part of a spectrum of if people find it useful and beneficial, because sometimes it is helpful to clearly note something, identify it, so that it can be acknowledged and then let go of. And that can be very useful and helps to clear the mind. the other side of the coin is that one can end up being a bit obsessive in trying to note everything and have a label for everything, and then cluttering the mind with noting, and then it leads to agitation, and then trying to figure out, what was that sound? What was that thought? So there's a certain element of, or perceived element of security in trying to note it, but it can lead to filling the mind too much with extraneous activity, so that any tool in meditation, any technique, for it to be functioning properly, should be leading to, should be something that leads to increase in wholesome dhammas and decrease in unwholesome dhammas, increase in peacefulness, decrease in agitation, increase in happiness, decrease in suffering. Those are just fundamental perspectives that one has to be recollecting, and then one can pick up any kind of technique and see, okay, is it meaningful? Is it useful? Is it beneficial for me? As opposed to the method or the technique taking over. This is a question that's similar to one that I answered just before, but there's a nuance to it that's useful. I was interested to hear the definition of mental formations as volitional. When I look at my mind, it sometimes seems like an undirected random generator of flashing images and unbidden thoughts, sometimes embarrassingly perverse. I can only rest easily when I recollect not-self. Could you help me reconcile that with volitionality? So that I think with the, just as I was saying, that the much of the images and thoughts that pop up in the mind, are more like the perceptual process, trying to sort of figure it out, association, and then thoughts being generated, and there's a spectrum of weak or stronger volitions, but it is really helpful to be bringing to mind that the characteristic of not self. Because if those thoughts were our self, boy, that's really embarrassing to have a self like that. And so that it's a lot easier to let go of and just, okay, this is it. That's the nature of these thought processes of mind, and that's what the mind does. And but then as we become more again part of a volitional formation is also mindfulness. A volitional formation is also discernment, so that as we apply those, then the mind starts to settle and become more clear. What suggestions do you have when thoughts of transgression of sila arise? I cannot change the past, but I have regrets. I think one of the things with thoughts of transgression of sila, it's good to recognize if it's something that because there are boundaries that one takes in order to recognize what are the impulses and volitions in the mind. And learning how to understand that. So that, there's thoughts of transgression of sila arise. Do we act on it? And for the most part, I would expect that most people here, you know, don't act on these impulses that aren't virtuous, and to recollect that, to remember that certainly for the vast majority of all these various thoughts, they don't actually act on them. That one has done in the past. That's a reality. And one has regret, but the regret shouldn't be feeding a sense of a sense of suffering. The regret, if there is regret, it's learning how to channel that into the intention to be more skillful, the intention to be more present, the intention to be more more wise. And so then it's a whatever regrets one has, they can be transformed into something that is positive and wholesome, and then it's the one's really using it in a beneficial way, and those aspects of regret or remorse are then a nutriment, because this is one of the things in when we think of the cause and effect processes. It isn't as if we just get on to a fast track of the wholesome, positive things, and it's just as it takes one off to greater heights of wholesome and positive. It's the reality is that wholesome, in terms of the karmic process, the wholesome can condition more wholesome states. The wholesome can condition unwholesome. One can. It's just the nature. Mindfulness and wisdom have to be functioning all the time. And the same, say the unwholesome. Can be a cause for increased unwholesome, but the unwholesome can be a cause for the wholesome, in the sense that it's an unwholesome mental state, thinking of regret and remorse, the mind is kind of down from that, but then it can be a seed for the developing of an urgency or a wish to develop wholesome qualities that protect one and protect others, the development of virtue. Those that's when the unwholesome is a conditioning factor for, on a karmic level, for the wholesome, for the good. Okay, please explain the inner workings of right intention and its karmic effect. Right intention, from the Buddha's perspective, the thoughts of renunciation, nekamma sankappa, of generosity, thoughts of of non-ill will. And it's interesting how the Buddha casts it in the negative as opposed to, so that non-ill will, as and which would tend to generate, say, loving kindness and compassion, or loving kindness and thoughts of non-harming, which is more thoughts of compassion. And of course the karmic effect of when the mind directs itself to generosity, to loving kindness, compassion, those are all extremely bright states, and would lead to increased well-being and happiness, clarity. It's a natural result. We have a short break.